Frequency Podcast Network. Stories that matter, podcasts that resonate.
The Ontario government is being sued.
Well, members of a class action lawsuit against the Ford government for their cancellation of the Ontario Basic Income pilot are urging the government to pay up.
That is a clip from a recent global news story about the lawsuit. In 2017, the Ontario Liberal government, led by Kathleen Wynne, instituted a basic income pilot where participants in Hamilton, Thunder Bay, and Lindsay, Ontario, would receive $1,400 a month for 3 years. It was being tested out as a potential alternative to other social supports like Ontario Works and ODSP, which offer less money and have much stricter rules around eligibility. You may have heard of it as simply the basic income pilot. When Doug Ford's Conservative government took office in 2018, one of the first things they did was cancel that basic income pilot, which was then only 1 year into the three-year program. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and you're listening to In This Economy, where we help you understand the systems that create your money problems, from grocery bills to mortgage renewals and everything in between. Basic income is an idea that's sometimes brought up as a potential solution to all of these money problems. But what does it really mean? And could it actually work? Because the Ford government scrapped the project so early, the only data we really have from that one is anecdotal. Stories from the folks who participated, and we'll hear from one of those people later in this episode. But there have been no shortage of other basic income pilots over the years that we can learn from. So we called up an expert who has. Evelyn Forget is a health economist at the School of Medicine at the University of Manitoba, where she has been studying the effects and feasibility of basic income for many years. She's also written a couple of books on the subject, including Basic Income for Canadians, From the COVID-19 Emergency to Financial Security for All. But before we get into the history and the context of basic income, we thought maybe we needed a basic definition of what we're talking about when we talk about basic income.
Basic income, at its heart, is a cash transfer from the government to families and to individuals so that they can meet some of their basic living expenses. Now, in Canada, we have sort of a consensus about what we mean by basic income. And so in Canada, we're talking about an income that's targeted towards lower income individuals and lower income families. So the amount of money you receive depends on how much money you have from other sources. And the easiest way to think about it is something like the Canada Child Benefit, which is in effect a basic income for families with kids under 18. If they have no money from any other source, they receive the full amount, which right now is about $7,400, I think, for a child under six. And as their income from other sources increases, if they're working, for example, but they don't earn enough to raise themselves above the poverty line, in fact, a little bit beyond that, they receive a smaller basic income. And it slowly declines as their income increases, so that by the time you get to middle and upper incomes, families aren't receiving the money at all. And so that's the way we think about a basic income. And its key characteristic is that it's unconditional money. So you don't have to show your caseworker rent receipts, for example. You can get the money whether you're working or not working. If you're not working at the full amount, if you're working but not earning enough to raise yourself above the poverty line, you'd receive a smaller basic income. That's essentially what we mean by basic income.
I know you have been thinking about this stuff for years. Has the way you think about it changed at all over the most recent period of economic uncertainty and an affordability crisis and rising interest rates? Does that change how you think about it or how people perceive it?
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm going to tell you a longer story here.
Sure.
When I first started thinking about basic income, I was working as a health economist. And the question for health economists in Canada is, how are we going to pay for this healthcare system? My office is in the Health Sciences Center, which is in downtown Winnipeg, one of the lowest income postal codes in the country. And it's perfectly clear pretty quickly, just talking to patients, talking to providers and so on, that a lot of the people we're treating in the healthcare system are there because of the consequences of their lives. They're there because they've spent a long time working at hard jobs, living in inadequate housing, not having enough money to feed themselves regularly or well, not having enough to take care of themselves. So I remember this old project that took place in Canada a long time ago called MinCom in the mid-70s. And I went back looking for that. And when I started working on the project, it was really historical more than anything. People weren't talking about basic income. It was something that preoccupied people, but it wasn't seen as a real policy opportunity or policy stance. And I think over time, we've recognized that the economy has changed in so many ways. You know, we had the financial shocks of 2010, 2011, 2012, where so many people lost their jobs. And we knew that the labor market wasn't working the way it used to work. People used to be able to graduate from school and they counted on getting a job that they'd hold for most of their career, most of their lives. They'd live very well. And now we're seeing people graduate from university, graduate from high school and moving into short-term contracts and doing a lot of precarious work, jobs that might disappear over time, restarting again and again, working in temporary employment. It's hard to build a life like that. So people began to focus on other ways of making it possible for people to live well. And then, of course, the pandemic came along and that that raised a whole lot of other questions. There are lots of times when the economy is shocked by factors that you really have no control over. And so, again, the government began to think about ways that you could get money into the hands of people who needed it so they could carry on their lives and society could continue. So in a sense, it hasn't changed. I mean, the kinds of things we focus on change depending on what happens. But the one thing that's certainly happened in more recent years is that everything's become a whole lot less certain than it used to be. There's a lot more precarity in employment. There's a lot more uncertainty about one's ability to take care of a family, for example, to house and to feed people well. And so basic income to me just becomes more and more a necessity. We can look around at the way we've been providing support to people who need a little bit of extra help, income assistance, social assistance, and we know that those programs don't work very well. Certainly after the pandemic, we've seen tent cities expand across the country. So we know we've got a lot of difficulty with homelessness. We've got a lot of difficulty with even just accessing basic food in a very wealthy country like Canada. And I think we have to be asking ourselves hard questions about whether we're doing the best job we can do to ensure that people have what they need in order to support themselves.
That's all great context, and we'll hear more about MinCom Manitoba in just a second. But first, a quick sidebar here about how the Ontario pilot program was meant to work. The Ontario Basic Income pilot was designed to follow a tax credit model. Single participants would receive around $17,000 minus 50% of any earned income. Couples would receive $24,000. To be eligible, participants needed to be between the ages of 18 and 64, living in one of the test regions, and living on an annual income of less than $24,000 for single people or $48,000 for a couple. For the duration of the project, participants could go to school or work. The basic income would simply decrease by 50 cents for every dollar they earned by working. That's it in a nutshell. So back to Evelyn and the MinCom Manitoba project.
Well, it was sort of an interesting time. The experiment took place in the mid-1970s, and this was a time when people across North America were rethinking the way we delivered income assistance. So there were four experiments that took place in the U.S., and Canada being Canada decided we needed our own experiment. And so the federal government at the time decided that they wanted to run an experiment in Canada. And Manitoba was fairly quick off the mark. We just elected our first ever NDP government. And what happened was that there were two test sites chosen in Manitoba, Winnipeg, and a little town called Dauphin, Manitoba. And they ran a little bit differently. In Winnipeg, the researchers came into town and they chose a relatively small proportion of the population and registered them and offered a basic income if their income fell below the approved threshold. And the idea was that they could look at the results, they could give people the opportunity to receive a basic income if they needed it for 3 years, and compare results for those people with a group of matched controls who didn't receive a basic income but made do with other programs that were available to them, and to find out how their lives were different. Dauphin worked a little bit differently. There, the entire town effectively was told that if their income fell below a particular threshold, they could receive a basic income if they wanted to participate. And so that town effectively became a test site for 3 years. They received money between 75 and 78. And data was collected at the time, and it was sort of stored away. By the time the experiment ended, policy had moved on, and governments weren't so keen to get the information out anymore. Huh. And so it moved around a little bit, and the data actually ended up stored in archives in Manitoba. And about 15 years ago now, I went in search of that data. When the experiment was run in the 1970s, the researchers really had one basic question in mind. A lot of people feared that if you offered people a basic income, they'd stop working. So they were really worried that there would be a reduction in the number of hours worked, people would quit their jobs. Hmm. Some work was done at the time, and they discovered that that in fact did not happen. There was no big reduction in work effort. Interestingly enough, there were two groups who did work less, and I'll just mention them because I sort of picked up on that. One of the groups was new mothers, and this is just a little bit of history. In the 1970s, we didn't have parental leaves, and maternity right. leaves were very short. And a lot of new mothers decided that the 4 weeks they were entitled to for maternity leave was a pretty miserly response to giving birth. And so they used the income to buy themselves longer parental leaves. And that's interesting because as a society, we've decided that parental leave is a very positive thing for families, for society as a whole, for the children. Mm-hmm. But the other group, and this is interesting, the language they used at the time was young unattached males. That is, young males who hadn't married, didn't have children, reduced their work effort really significantly.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. And that seemed to feed everybody's prejudices. Oh, yeah. All these kids sitting around playing whatever the 1970s equivalent of video games were, you know, avoiding their responsibilities. When I started looking at the data, I was interested in something different. I wanted to know how it had improved people's lives, whether a basic income was in fact a good thing for families. And I remembered all those young unattached males. And so I did two things. I gathered some data on high school registration and I talked to people who participated in the experiment. Mm-hmm. And the reason I gathered the education material was because one of the things I discovered had happened was a nice little bubble in high school completion rates. Huh. So there was an increase in people graduating from high school. And when I tracked down people who'd participated in the experiment, they all told me the same thing. If you were living in a small prairie town in the middle of the 1970s and your family had no money, especially if you were a boy, because there were good jobs out there for boys.
Right.
The idea was you'd turn 16 and you'd leave school. You could legally leave school and you could get yourself a job. And then the family's money could go to support your younger brothers and sisters. And when income came along, a lot of those boys had an opportunity to stay in school for another year or two to graduate from high school. And that still sends chills down my spine when I think about it. Because if you think of the different life that somebody who graduated from grade 12 in 1976, for example, and somebody who didn't graduate from high school, the different lives that they've lived since then, it's pretty dramatic. Mm-hmm. Not only their own lives, but the lives of their children, the opportunities they can offer to their families are so different. So those boys who left school early, left school without graduating in 1976, they could get jobs, but they ended up working in agriculture.
Right.
And of course, if you drive down the highway now, you realize that the farms that used to employ two dozen boys during a harvest are now being run by a 55-year-old farmer sitting in a great big tractor,
right.
great big combine. So employment in agriculture has just collapsed since the 1970s. The other jobs they were getting were in factories, and we've seen right. factories being hollowed out across North America since the 1970s. The work's being done in South Asia, for example, and not in Canada any longer. So a lot of those boys would have ended up with long periods of unemployment, would have struggled to make their way in the world since the 1970s. So that education finding was interesting. The other thing I was really interested in was health outcomes. And I was very, very lucky in a sense because universal health care had been introduced in Canada just before the experiment started. And one of the side effects of having a government-run healthcare system is a lot of data is collected.
Right.
So every time you see a doctor, every time you go to the hospital, there's a record of that. And we have very good data access in Manitoba. So I was able actually to find the people who were living in Dauphin during the period and to look at hospitalization and look at contact with doctors. I couldn't actually tell whether they were healthier. But if you assume that they're in the hospital less, so, you know, it's not a big step to say if they're spending less time in hospital, probably they were healthier. And I actually found a big reduction in hospitalization for people who were eligible to receive the basic income compared to a matched sample that weren't receiving basic income. So an 8.5% reduction in hospitalization is a pretty dramatic finding for a country that currently spends an awful lot of money on hospitals.
I guess my next question is kind of obvious then. If this improved outcomes and didn't appreciably diminish the amount of work being done, why did it end? You mentioned that the experiment was over, political winds were changing maybe. What caused it to stop?
Well, they were, but it was only ever planned to run until 1978.
Okay.
So it was a short-term experiment. Of course, the people who were involved in the experiment hoped that the results would be so convincing that governments would make changes to policy and make a basic income available to everybody. That didn't happen, and it didn't happen for all kinds of reasons. You know, one of the reasons was the political winds were changing. In the middle of the experiment, we had an election in Manitoba, and that first ever NDP government was replaced by a government that was much less interested in expanding social supports. This was the first Trudeau government, you know, and it was a minority government, and they were sort of struggling to stay in power. So I think politically they were interested in different things. But I mean, the politics were actually a function. I'm an economist, so you have to forgive me if I bring everything back to economics. If you think about what was happening during the 1970s, this was a time where there were a couple of big oil price shocks and interest rates spiked to, in some cases, 18 and 20%. People were losing their houses. Inflation was running at about 13%. And so Canada entered the 1970s saying poverty is a terrible thing and we should do something about it. By the time we get to 1978, people were saying, oh my gosh, it's not poor people we're going to be thinking about anymore. Let's start thinking about middle class people. Think about people who are losing their houses. We'll think about unemployment. We'll think about inflation and all these terrible things. It just, as it always does, poverty got put on the back burner as we tended to focus on other things. So that's what happened in the 1970s.
An example or a few examples of some of the other projects that have been run since the Mincom project in Canada and how they worked broadly?
Sure. I think one of the most interesting recent experiments actually took place in Vancouver. A young psychologist by the name of Jiaying Zhao worked with, it's just a pilot experiment, it's quite small. But she offered a basic income to 50 unhoused people. So 50 people who were really struggling in Vancouver. And she compared them to a control group. And the question was, if you give people a basic income, how do their lives change? And of course, this ran for about a year. And at the end of the year, people who received the basic income were much more likely to be housed. They were eating better. They were self-reported health had improved. So a lot of things about their lives had improved during that period. That experiment is being expanded and applied in different parts of British Columbia as we speak. There have been experiments all over the world. I mean, as we speak, there are more than 100 cities in the U.S. that are running short-term basic income guarantee experiments, usually with foundation money, some of it with government money. And so quite a lot of data is currently being collected in the U.S. Experiments have taken place in various parts of the U.K., in low and middle-income countries around the world.
Have any of those experiments found a negative impact? Because I think we could talk all day about all the positive impacts, and you just illustrated them with the Mincome Project. Are there any experiments out there where you look at the data and you're like, oh, this didn't work for some reason, unlike all the other ones?
You know, no. No, there really aren't. The results tend to be very positive, and some of them are predictable. I mean, for crying out loud, I started working on this because of the negative effect that poverty has on people's health. Well, it's not a surprise that if people have enough money to house themselves and to feed themselves and to take care of their kids, families are going to be healthier and happier. And so if you ask them if they're healthier and happier, by and large, they say, yeah, pretty much we are. And one of the real findings of that Vancouver experiment, and I should have said this at the time, Dr. Zhao looked at one concern that a lot of people have expressed, that is, if you give money to certain people, those people will increase their expenditure on what she called temptation goods. Mm-hmm. Temptation goods is gambling, drugs, alcohol. And so she actually looked, you know, what did people spend the money on? She found no, I mean, certainly people spent money on drugs, alcohol, and gambling, but there was no increase in expenditure on those goods among the people who received a basic income relative to the control group. So that lends, I think, further support to my claim that, you know, people tend to spend the money in ways that improves their lives. And that's, you know, that's one of the assumptions I think that lies behind a basic income. We could give people vouchers for food and housing or whatever it is we think people ought to be spending money on. But if you give people money, they tend to know what their families need and they spend the money accordingly.
Given that in every case it improves people's lives, why has it been such a hard sell? Why almost 50 years now, I guess, after the Mincome Project, are we still talking about pilot projects? The whole point of a pilot project is that when it works, it becomes permanent.
Except that Canada is the land of pilot projects. We have all kinds of successful pilot projects.
That and government reports and commissions.
Oh, yeah. That as well. Why? You know, I can tell you that data has been collected in, I can't tell you how many different environments, different experiments, different ways. We can say, I think, definitively that there's no big reduction in work effort when you give people a basic income. People don't quit $40,000 a year jobs in order to live on $20,000 a year.
Right.
They don't reduce their hours of work. If you design the project properly, people don't stop working when they receive a basic income. But one of the big fears, and we hear it over and over and over again, is that people will stop working. And it's such a deep and inherent prejudice, I think, just a belief about the way people respond to opportunities, the way they respond to public programs. So I think part of it is changing people's attitudes, and evidence seems not to do that. Statistical evidence, all of the evidence we collect on the way people respond in the labor market doesn't convince the average person. And when I say that, it doesn't convince voters that people won't stop working if you give them a basic income. So I think one reason it hasn't happened is that we have, I think, deep in our hearts, this desire to distinguish between the deserving poor and the undeserving poor. That's very old-fashioned language because people were using it in the 16th century in England. It's a very deeply held set of values, and it's hard to challenge that. So I think one reason it doesn't happen is because a lot of people don't believe it will work. They believe it will discourage people from working, evidence notwithstanding. The other fear is that it'll end up costing a lot of money. And there's no question that a basic income costs money. Mm-hmm. Is it a spectacularly expensive undertaking? Well, no. I think a lot of work has been done on this by the Parliamentary Budget Officer and by other people. It's entirely within the realm of what Canada can afford to do. But more than that, I think we need to think about a basic income as an investment. It's an investment in people. if people have money up front, let me put it this way. There's hardly any social problem that you can think of in Canada that's not made worse by poverty.
Right.
If you give people enough money to make good decisions and to live good lives, we're not going to pay the cost of poverty downstream by expanding our prison system or by expanding our emergency departments so that we can deal with the consequences of poverty. We are medicating poverty. We are using our prisons to treat poverty. Mm-hmm. And that's a very inefficient way of making decisions about the kind of society in which we want to live.
I know that you're an economist and not a psychologist, but how do we get rid of that pervasive stereotype around this that causes people to not want to back these programs for fear that people will be lazy or they won't work? You mentioned it's so ingrained. How do you start to change that?
It is deeply ingrained. I am an economist, and I keep thinking that somehow the data is going to have an effect it hasn't had until now. But I think we can think about the things that have worked. I started by saying that the Canada Child Benefit is effectively a basic income for families with kids under 18.
Mm-hmm.
I think if we look at the consequences of the Canada Child Benefit, these have been extremely positive. We've seen, for example, that mothers are not less likely to work, they're more likely to work because they can use the money to pay for childcare. So it increases work effort, it doesn't decrease it. The poverty rate for families with young children has declined dramatically since it was expanded in 2016. So we're seeing very positive effects from those programs. And, you know, I want to be at one level, you're always disappointed because change doesn't happen as quickly as you think it ought to.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, we've made tremendous progress since the 1970s. The Canada Child Benefit is a big one. But we've also now got OAS and the Guaranteed Income Supplement for seniors, which is a different kind of a basic income. Again, it's unconditional cash that goes to people. It depends solely on the size of their income. But that money's improved the lives of seniors. It's reduced the poverty rate among seniors. And we can see that as a very positive program. And I think most Canadians would say, yeah, the Canada Child Benefit and, you know, OAS, GIS, you know, these things could be increased maybe. Maybe we need a few more dollars in them. But these are, by and large, very good programs that improve the lives of the people who receive it.
Right.
The one great hole in our system is dealing with working age adults. And we still want to restrict the kind of support we offer to people who are of working age. And again, if we think about the data, the very largest proportion of support for working age adults in this country goes to people with disabilities.
Right.
It doesn't go to people who could go out and get a job tomorrow if they wanted to. Most of the people who rely on government support for long periods of time have some pretty significant barriers to employment of one type or another, either undiagnosed disabilities or literacy issues, all kinds of issues. So, you know, I think we need to think a little bit more about those kinds of programs that are currently in place and the way they could be improved.
The last thing I want to ask you then is for people listening to this show and this podcast in general, who are probably looking at their bank statements or their non-existent homes and thinking after listening to this, that a universal basic income could actually help them. What do they do next to try to make that happen? What's the most effective way of advocating for this?
You know, I think we have to be very clear with our political representatives of whatever party at both the provincial and the federal level. I think that a number of provinces are struggling in all kinds of ways. And, you know, provinces are responsible for providing income assistance, providing support to people. And they should be open to creative ways of doing that. Everybody knows that the current system is not working well. So I think we have to be very active and we have to be very vocal. There are a number of organizations across the country that are supporting the idea of a basic income, advocating a basic income. It's easy to Google Basic Income Canada Network, which will put you in contact with all kinds of other organizations, local organizations with which you can participate. I think governments fear big changes because they fear what the reaction of voters will be. And I think there are a number of voters who recognize that there are certain benefits to ensuring that families get the money up front rather than waiting until a crisis occurs and then dealing with the crisis. And I think they need to know that. They need to know that we're ready for change.
Evelyn, thank you so much for this. It's really informative, and I understand the long history of this a little better right now. You're an economist. If I had to ask you to place a bet, I'd call you back in 10 years. Do we have a national basic income program in Canada?
Oh, don't ask me to time. That's like timing the stock market. You know, I used to say with great certainty that before I die, we'll have a basic income in this country. I'm expecting to live a long life. That's what I fear.
Good.
That's what I fear. I think we're moving in the right direction. But, you know, it's depressingly slow sometimes. And it's depressing to hear the same old arguments being trotted out, contrary to the evidence. I think we need to keep active no matter what's happening out there. We need to keep recognizing that this is the right path forward.
That's Evelyn Forget, health economist at the University of Manitoba. For more of her thinking about basic income, you can check out her books, including Radical Trust, Basic Income for Complicated Lives. And thank you so much to Evelyn for sharing her knowledge and experience with us. Now, Evelyn was able to analyze the data, but we also wanted to hear from someone with lived experience, just to get a sense of how basic income can transform a life. Tracy Mashevsky is one of the plaintiffs in the class action suit against the Ontario government. In 2017, she was living in Lindsay, Ontario, when a friend told her about the basic income pilot program that was looking for applicants.
So I followed her to her initial interview and I said, I'm sorry, I don't have an appointment, but is there any way that I can get more information?
After a lengthy interview process, Tracy was approved. She received her first payment in November of 2017.
So the basic income was a complete godsend to me. Everything in my life changed, economically, physically, emotionally, socially, even. I have physical health limitations. So I'd always been looking for something that I could do from home because I can't work outside the home.
Tracy used some of the money she received from the basic income pilot to start her own niche business.
I had developed an allergy to sulfates, and that's in everything. And so I had then had to start teaching myself how to make personal care products for myself because I couldn't go out and buy them anymore. And I had thought about how many other people have that same allergy. And so when I found out that I was accepted with the basic income, I thought, well, I could make this into a business. It can work around my health limitations and it can help other people who have allergies or who just want healthier living where they're not ingesting or absorbing toxic chemicals all the time. So I went out and I got a line of credit and I hired a lawyer and did the title search and started incorporation and I bought all the ingredients. So I started a business and then socially I started going out to a place called Home, which is the homeless shelter. And I started teaching other people how to make their own products on a budget. And I did that with Reach for Recovery. And so I was giving back to the community as I was bringing in money from the business. I was also going out to the community and doing that as well. Socially also, we were able to travel and see family more often. All of our family has been spread out all over Ontario. And so it was, I mean, it costs a lot. Gas is a lot. And then it allowed us to eat better. So we weren't trying to figure out how we were going to afford food or we were going to pay the oil, right? Or hydro or whatever. And I was able to get, I had had surgery on my knee and I couldn't really afford physiotherapy on the fixed budget. So when I got the money, I got a membership to the Y and I started swimming. And that turned into, I was swimming like twice a week, then three times a week, then four times a week. And by 2020, I ran my first triathlon. So everything, like I said, everything in my life changed when the basic income gave us a top up.
Tracy made plans that relied on the basic income lasting 3 years. that's what was promised.
My three-year plan, because the pilot was supposed to last for 3 years, my three-year plan, I sat down and I figured out that I could be off of ODSP by the end of the 3 years. And that was using the ODSP payments, part of that, to pay down the line of credit and get rid of that by the end of the 3 years as well. Unfortunately, because it got canceled a year and a half in, halfway through, I was then back on ODSP, saddled with a $15,000 line of credit that I couldn't pay for. And with the money not coming in from the stipend, I couldn't get the bulk ingredients to make the products or pay out. I'd already paid out 2 years of tables at farmers markets, and I lost all of that too.
Tracy was understandably angry. She started writing letters to politicians, to newspapers, to whoever she could think of.
I approached a lawyer friend of mine that I knew, Mike Perry, and I gave him the letter and I said, this is what I'm sending out. And I don't know what to do with the anger. So this is what I'm doing. This is all I can do is send letters. So a little while later, he called me and he said, would you like to get together for coffee? And I said, sure. And I met him for coffee and he says, how mad are you? And I said, if you have an idea, I'm open to it. And he said, how would you like to sue the government? And I said, what? And he said, how would you like to try and get the cancellation overturned? I said, I'm in.
Now, Tracy Mashevsky is one of the plaintiffs representing a class action lawsuit against the Ontario government. Having experienced its benefits firsthand, if only temporarily, Tracy believes basic income is something everyone deserves.
Everybody needs a floor to stand on if things get bad. And we are just one injury or one less paycheck away from being in a situation that you can lose your home or not be able to afford your car to get to work, and then where are you? It's a game changer. And if we start looking at it from the narrative that it's for all people, in case you get sick or injured or lose your job or whatever, and start looking at the people rather than the money, that's where we need to start. It's about making people healthier, because when we're healthier, we're more productive.
Thanks to Tracy for sharing that story with us. If you have money problems, we want to hear from you. You can email us at hello@itepod.ca. You can also call us and just talk about it. Leave a voicemail at 416-935-5935. And we don't need your real name, but we do need your real numbers. One, where we can call you back and talk to you about it some more, and two, the numbers of any money problems you're struggling with. If you liked this show and you want more, please share and tell your friends to listen. You can also like and rate and review and follow and all those good things that your podcast apps tell you to do when you really like a show. I am your host and your executive producer, Jordan Heath Rawlings. This episode was written and produced by Allison Broverman and Stephanie Phillips. The sound design was done by Robin Edgar. Mary Jubrin is our digital editor. Diana Kay is our manager of business development. Together, that makes us the Frequency Podcast Network, a division of Rogers. Thanks again for taking the time to listen, and we'll talk to you next week on In This Economy.